All right, welcome to class today. I just wanted to start off by reminding you that when I give you 3 weeks for an assignment, it's because I think there's 3 weeks of work to do. If you're not halfway done your homework, you are behind. That said, questions, comments, concerns, other things for me before we dive in. Do you have questions for me?
Oh.
Yes.
Can you maybe elaborate on how you interpolate three colors for the trig function?
How do you interpolate three colors? Sure. Let's just look at when did we do this? We did this day, right? Yeah. So a week and I guess that was a week ago. Last week. Last week we talked about how we would do this. We talked about how linear interpolation would fill in coordinates across and how we could do that with colors as well. And then I don't think we did a triangle example of that, but we did somewhere here. We did an actual stepping through it linearly along an edge. Okay, and so you do the same thing, right? You can add as many extra coordinates as you want. So here we did x, y, and we arbitrarily added in red coordinates and showed how we can interpolate across them using the same vector algebra we used before. And so this is why, when we were talking about the triangle, what I said we did across the sides was a DDA algorithm, right? So we have that initial offset to get in. That offset will apply in red, green, and blue, just like all the other values. And then we can interpolate across. Does this help your question, or yes? Yeah.
Should we be rounding colors, or?
You should not round up the edges, anything at all. Not X's, not Y's, not reds, greens, blues. All of the rounding should happen only when you're actually drawing a pixel, which only happens on your horizontals. Yes?
When you said we can be one-off, does that mean like we can only be in total one-off, or can be like one-off in red, and one-off in green, and one-off in blue?
So I have not specified exactly how to round to colors, so your color each color component can be one-off. Technically, some directions of one-off are probably errors, but I'm not going to pay attention. Other questions? Okay, let me just also make, while I'm here, a reminder of a detail about how these assignments work. Right, so there is the required portion that's worth 50%, and then there is the optional portion that's also worth 50%. Has anybody added up the percentages? I believe there's about 260-something percent available in optional. Okay. What happens if you get 200% optional and 0% required? You get 50%. Now the optional will carry forward to future assignments, but the optional comes out of one pool of points and the required comes out of another pool of points across all the assignments, right? And the reason for this is the required are the things that if you don't know how to do them, people later will say you didn't really have graphics, did you, right? So they're required, and there will continue to be just a handful of required each subsequent assignment as we move along. So it is worth your while trying to get these really right. There is partial credit given on these based on how close it seems like you got. There generally, as I've mentioned before, but I'll mention again, there generally is not partial credit given on the optional. If you can't get it right, try something else. We may occasionally give partial credit if it's clear you were close but not quite there, but we don't have the staff power to spend a whole lot of time debugging everybody's detailed optional credit. So that's coming up. So I would hope most of you finish your required here and then here. Okay, yes?
How do we go about like constructing algorithms from like notes that we get in class?
That is a great question that in theory you're supposed to know before you get to this class. Right? In theory, how do you construct an algorithm based on how the algorithm works is supposed to be something you've learned along the way. Now, I recognize we may have done you a disservice and not worked through that. So in general, how do you construct code to do an algorithm? First, you make sure you can do it. You can't teach the computer to do something you can't. So if you can't go along and make, oh, not that one. If you can't make pictures like I make, and figure out what the number should be by hand, right? If you can't get this number, figure out how to get that number, right? Make sure you understand what it's doing. And then you can either go top down or bottom up is the basic two approaches to how you would do things. So, right, one is you start essentially functional decomposition. You say, okay, to do a triangle, I need to do the edges and then do the scan lines. And then you write, okay, edge. To do the edge, I need to, right, find an offset, and then step, and so on. And you just keep writing function after function with no bodies until eventually you get something concrete. This is sort of, this is what we call top-down design. Okay, you can also do bottom-up. Okay, you can say, I know how to fill a pixel. What can you do by filling pixels? I can build on top of filling pixels. I could do some function that just fills pixels. So I can do fill a scan line, where I just go across an X, right? That might be the next easier one, and you sort of build up. You're welcome to do either one. If you decide to sit down and try to write one master function that does it all, you are likely to hurt yourself. I actually recently just discovered, so I've been chatting a little bit with Charles Rice, who's teaching operating systems, and he was frustrated by the quality of code that he was seeing being turned in. And so we spent many more hours than is probably healthy for us running statistical analyses on code submitted. I haven't yet tried on graphics because there's so many languages it's harder to run it on, but there was a very strong correlation between smaller functions and on higher scores. Okay? And that isn't because we're scoring functions, it's a purely behavioral type of thing. But if you don't do functional decomposition, you get yourself confused. So try to make small little steps. And whether you're top down or bottom up by preference, that varies by you. It's also worth noting, by the end of this semester, you'll probably have written 2,000 to 3,000 distinct statements in your code. Although not all in one assignment, but that's been the average in past semesters. When you have that many, the chance you got it right the first time is vanishingly small. I don't know if we actually have... There's a book called The Mythical Man Month. Have any of you bumped in? No, very few of you. All right. So many years ago, there was an individual who... I have just forgotten his name. Who wrote The Mythical Man Month? Let's broaden your education. The Mythical Man Month was a book written by, I can never remember his name, which makes me feel bad. Fred Brooks, that's right, Fred Brooks. So in 1975, he published a book saying, hey, I've built several large systems. What he meant was operating systems, not that that's hugely important here. And I've learned stuff about them. Here's what I've learned. First off, if somebody says more people makes the problem go faster, they're wrong. Hence the Mythical Man Month, right? Adding staff power to a problem does not make it easier. But then he also says a lot of other things. One of his principles is, I think they actually have a list of his principles here. Do they have the one I'm thinking of? Nope, they don't. One of his principles was, oh, I guess it's called the second system effect. Make one to throw away. Okay, if you're working along and your triangle code is not working and you don't know why, start over. The final solution is like 10 lines. Okay, so if you get stuck in what you're doing, start over from first principles. It probably will be faster to build it having learned something from the first go than to try to fix your first go. Your mileage may vary, but I would encourage thinking along those lines often in this course. Other questions or follow-ons to these points? Yes?
Fan end?
Yeah.
One polygon of all the points?
Yeah.
Shade it. Does that kind of overlap with the previous ones where you have to figure out if things are overlapping or not?
Why, no, it does not. Did you want me to say more about that?
Well, yeah.
The fan in and strip in are literally just draw a bunch of triangles. And there's not clever draw triangles, it's just there is a rule. Okay? The rule for the fan in is we always draw from the first point and then the other two move. For the strip in, it's we always draw from the last three. although there's weird swapping of the middle pair. And that's just what they are. They're actually quite common in real code because they let you specify points less often, which reduces bandwidth talking to the graphics card. But yeah, that's all they do. Other questions? So, as contrast, these don't do that, right? These use some sort of fill rule, either an even odd or a non-zero, to make pseudo vertices where none existed, if you were thinking of it in a triangle system, although typically you don't actually turn into triangles. Other questions? Yeah?
There was a question on the quiz on last night that had like a mean of zero.
Yeah, it turns out I forgot to list any answers correct. I fixed that right before I came to class. Yeah, it was a question that had four multiple choice and all of them were incorrect. That was a bad decision on my, mistake on my part. So I added the key. It should now show you what your grade is. Other questions? All right. So last time we talked some about Bezier curves. And the observant in you, by which I mean the people that did the reading as well as attending lecture, may have noticed I did not teach them the way they were taught in the write-up. The two teachings are equivalent but different, trying to give you multiple ways of thinking about that. I'm going to do that again today with Bezier curves. B-splines, I mean. Actually, also with Bezier curves. We're going to teach yet another way of thinking about them. There are multiple ways of thinking about these things. They're all cross-equivalent. If you prefer the way it's written up in the write-up, go for it, right? The Wikipedia article or however you want to get it. But we're going to explore today. We actually have several topics tentatively on the schedule. We have B-spline and blobby, which are curve drawing techniques, I guess, for lack of a better term. And then we may or may not also get to the topic of fragment shaders in the 2D space, which is a lot easier to describe in the 3D space we'll get to later, and alpha associated with that. These are unrelated topics in almost every way. So we will see how far we get through the curves, and we may or may not get into a lot or a little of fragment shaders. It depends on how it goes. However, I also want to notice, on the schedule for next class, it just says math. All right, what are we doing in class tomorrow, or Thursday? It has become evident to me that not everybody that comes into this class has a similar level of math maturity, or math exposure, or however we want to word this. So what are we going to do? We're going to talk about vectors, and how vectors multiply by matrices, and we're going to talk about the definitions of differentiation and integration. If you think, I know all of that, you don't need to show up, okay? That's all we are doing. If you're like, ooh, integrals, then show up, and we'll try to make you ready for the things that will follow, okay? We will also mostly do math on Tuesday, but it is unlikely many of you actually understand homogeneous coordinates very well. Some of you may, and that's great. You're still always welcome to skip class, right? But I expect most of you will benefit from class a week from today. I suspect, let's say, in practice, if I ask for show of hands, how many of you need this? 10% of you raise your hands, and then 60% of you will show up, right? That's fine. We all feel self-conscious about how bad we are at math. It's fine. But that's what's happening in class on Thursday. That will happen regardless of where we stop today. So if we have to cut off in the middle of fragment shaders, we're not going to pick up on fragment shaders again until next week. Because I don't want to have a half stuff you need to be here for and half stuff that some of you don't in class on Thursday. So just know that that's coming up. All right, that feels like more context than I really wanted to give. So we're going to talk today about B-splines. From the reading, what did you get about the idea of a B-spline? What is a B-spline? Anybody have anything from the reading they think they are confident enough is true they don't mind saying aloud? Yeah?
A way of splicing together multiple Bezier curves.
Okay, so we have multiple Bezier. This is absolutely true. That's not where the, is that where the acute goes? I thought so, okay. Ah. Anything else you noticed about B-splines? All right, then we'll start here. I'm going to start with the most common type of B-spline, and then we'll generalize it to what they really are. So the most common type of B-spline is a cubic B-spline. Okay, a cubic B-spline is a way of generating cubic Beziers. So a cubic B-spline initially is going to look a lot like a cubic Bezier. I'm going to have this polyline, or like a Bezier. I'm going to have a polyline made of lots of control points in some order. And it is going to tell me a curve. And the curve is going to go sort of close to the points. Okay? But how it goes sort of close to the points is going to be different than it does for a Bezier. One of the problems with higher order Beziers from an artist's standpoint is the control points in the middle don't seem to matter very much. If you go through the de Castelgeau algorithm or the parameterization algorithm that's in the Wikipedia article, either one, you'll realize it sticks pretty closely to this, but then it basically just like goes almost straight and then swings by, right? It tends to matter very little what these integer points are. You have to move this a whole lot before you see anything moving in the curve. So this is one problem people didn't like with higher order Beziers. The other thing that makes higher order Beziers problematic is that when you move one of these points, the whole curve moves. Every single point on the curve except the two endpoints moves when any one of the control points move. So you neither have local control nor do you have strong control. And that makes it hard for artists to deal with. They expect to move something and see something move. Instead, they move something and they see everything move and not enough and then the wrong direction. Okay? So we very rarely see artists being given access to higher order Bezier curves. They tend to understand relatively easy cubic. They tend to have trouble with quartic and above. So when we want to give them a lot of control points that control a curve, we typically use a B-spline. The basic concept of a cubic B-spline is we just use these points to define new Bezier curves. And for a cubic, it's very simple. We cut each line segment in thirds. I'm going to ignore the end because it's slightly weird. So I'm just going to cut each of these in thirds. Those will be control points. All of those third marks will be control points. And the other control points will be halfway between ones that were at a corner. And those are my control points. Now, what I do at the ends, there's different end conditions I could do here. Okay? So I often will just keep this point here, or we could delete that last Bezier curve, or different things. But as we think about this, here is a cubic Bezier. So I end up with one cubic Bezier for every line segment in my B-spline. I end up with more control points than I have in my B-spline, but I end up with these. You'll notice that the way I constructed it, I'm guaranteed that this will be cotangent. Because this line and this line are on the same line. And we know that Bezier curves are tangent to their control thing at the end. So we're going to get some level of smoothness. By this construction, we also actually get second derivative smoothness. So in the space of dealing with curves, there's different ways of describing smoothness, how smooth it is. It turns out that, so we call zeroth derivative smoothness, or C0 is just they touch. So C0 means they touch. Okay? C1 means with the same slope. And C2 means with the same curvature. And this is usually all we care about as artists. We could go on to C3 and C4 and so on, but we don't. Right, the only reason we really go to C2 is because shiny things. It turns out that the shine has 1 degree less continuity than the shape. And this actually happens because of rules about how reflections work. Anyway, not hugely important. But if we have C1 continuity, same slope, but not C2, sudden change in curvature, then we will see a discontinuity in the reflections. And so for shiny objects, we want C2. If they weren't shiny, C1 is usually enough, but lots of things have a little bit of shine. So we usually want C2 in the real world. Okay? This is usually all we need. This curve has a nice behavior. If I move one of the original control points, it only affects two Bezier curves. Hey, actually, I guess it checks a little bit of this one, right? But like this, the effect stops there and there. It is bounded. Okay, so I don't have to worry about moving something in the middle changing the whole curve. And because it's relatively closely attached to things, it has a fairly large direct impact on the shape of the curve. Artists tend to like, once they get used to the fact the control point isn't on the surface, they tend to like B-splines reasonably well. So this is the basic cubic B-spline curve. They get more complicated than this, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But before we do that, questions about cubic B-splines? Yes?
I forgot the name of the guy who made the other album, the Dick Castle or whatever.
Dick Castle Show?
Dick Castle Show. In that one, how far would the effective bleed it out?
So on a Bezier curve, moving any control point changes every point on the curve. Yes?
Can you explain, how'd you get, is C0 just the point for the first one, and then C1 is the...
So the black line is C0. Right? At this point, they touch but are not don't have the same slope. The curve, the cubic Bezier curve gives me C2.
And then C1 would
be? C1 would be the same slope but not the same curvature. We have not seen a clear example of that, but here is an example. So if I had, say, I decided to make a tabletop out of a rectangle and a circle, at these points here, I would have C1 curvature. It would go from no curvature to suddenly having curvature. So I don't have curvature continuity, but I do have slope continuity. Does that make sense? Yes?
So you said that the ends can be like special cases.
Yeah.
Why would we do it any differently from the other?
So it turns out that if you just leave these points here, moving an end control point has more influence on the curve than moving a different control point. Because it actually touches the curve and it behaves a little differently. And so when you actually implement it, the math you have to do for this last segment is different than the math you have to do for the rest. So either from a it's mathematically simpler or from it gives the artist the same control everywhere. Right? Sometimes it's nice to have none of the control points on the curve, so the artist doesn't assume that some are on and some are off.
So does that mean that for this, the thing that we end up producing, we actually only start like
right, so one version is you just start it here. But then you have this control point that doesn't go on the curve at all. That's also not ideal, right? There isn't an ideal version here. Sometimes we will actually loop these things around. So sometimes we will add, I don't know, a control point here, and we'll make this sort of circular B-spline. Okay? And then everything is nice and smooth, and we have a loop. But that means we need a loop, and we don't always want a loop. So what you do at the ends, if there are ends, is always different than what you do other places because it doesn't have the same level of information. And anytime you do something different, somebody says you should have done something else. Yeah?
So we're basically taking a higher order Bezier curve and turning it into cubic ones?
Or? No.
Wait, what is the black line, I guess?
The black line is what we call the control points.
Okay, but it's...
They aren't directly related to Bezier control points in any way. Bezier curves have control points. B-splines have control points. They're different control points. Yes?
So you said this is a cubic B-spline?
Yes.
Is that because you divide each section into thirds?
That is because my end curves are cubic. So I'm creating a three-segment Bezier curves. Okay. There are other ways of subdividing this where I'd end up with quadratic or quartic or quintic or whatever kinds of curves in there I wanted. There are other division rules we could have used for the same control points. But we almost always use cubic. Other questions? Yes?
Do you path drawing tools like Photoshop and like Illustrator, do they create B-splines when you like create the draw path?
Typically, no. Typically, they do an interpolation spline instead that actually goes through the points you go through. These turn to be pretty good for styluses, but relatively bad if you're manually moving control points, because they tend to have non-local behavior that people don't really like. So there's actually lots of ways of doing this. In mathematics, we talk about this idea of a spline, which is actually an engineering tool. A spline is a piece of bent metal. And in a mechanical spline, these control points are called ducts, like quack quack ducts. And so we have splines with ducts, and then the spline sort of approximates the ducts. And anyway, in mathematics, you can come up with the algorithm that finds a polynomial that fits any arbitrary set of points in minimal way, and that's called the spline of those points. And they are non-local and have quadratic time to compute, and it turns out we almost never use them in graphics. So we don't use real splines, we use B-splines instead, which do Bezier curves instead of a giant polynomial. Okay. Let me just briefly talk about how we make arbitrary B-splines. And to do this, we're going to talk about the idea of blossoming, or blossoms. I'm going to start explaining blossoms in terms of Bezier curves, and then we'll talk about how they work for B-splines. And some of you are going to say, wow, that's so beautiful and elegant, and others of you are going to say, ugh. And I'm just preparing you for that, okay? Because it turns out that mathematically elegant is not a universal principle. All right, so let's consider this Bezier curve. One way of defining a Bezier curve is by defining a blossom at each control point, where a blossom is defined as a set of numbers. It is a set, not a list. It is not a coordinate. And the number of them is proportional to the ratio, the order of the B-spline. So for a Bezier curve, I would, for example, say 0, 0, 0, 0. 0, 0, 0, 1. We typically always show this in sorted order to represent it as a set. But for whatever reason, I have one too many. But for whatever reason, we don't typically use curly braces. We typically use parentheses for blossoms. I don't actually know why. No, I erased the wrong ones. I'm doing this poorly. 1, 1, 1. Okay. The rule with blossoms is I can interpolate between blossoms linearly by linearly interpolating any one of their coordinates. Okay, so to interpolate between these two blossoms, I would linearly interpolate one of their different coordinates. So for example, I can interpolate between the 0 and the 1. That's their only different coordinate, and it'd be linear across. So if I went a third of the distance, I would find 0, 1 third, 1. Okay, and this is just the definition of a blossom. Interpolating one coordinate happens linearly, okay? And I could also interpolate any of these others linearly. So I could also say, all right, these two differ in this last coordinate. So 0, 0, 1 third would be right there. And this one differ in the first coordinate. So 1 third, 1, 1 is right there. And if I keep doing this, if I keep interpolating between coordinates linearly, so these two points, I've actually got 2 1-thirds. Those are the same. Okay. Again, we typically sort these. So this is the same number as 0. Sorry, that is actually already sorted order. Okay. But I have these 1/3 are the same, but I have zeros and ones that are different. So I can interpolate between the 0 and the 1 there to find 0, 1/3, 1/3. Okay, so I pick two things that are different, I can interpolate between them. And similarly, I can interpolate these two. These two both have a 1, they both have a 1/3, but I've got a 1 and a 0. So let's find the spot in between those. I can get 1/3, 1/3, 1. And then between these two, I've got a 1 and a 0. So, not over there. Interpolate linearly. I can find over here 1/3, 1/3, 1/3. And this is the algorithm we did last time. This is the de Castelgeau algorithm. I'm trying to find a blossom where all of the values are the same. Question?
So we should just throw out any geometric kind of interpretation of these points.
They're not points. They're sets.
Yeah, okay.
Yep. They exist only in parameter space.
Yeah. If they're sets, how do they have like a meaningful definition of each coordinate?
There is no order to these.
Okay.
It's just I can find. So like if I consider, let's think more about this. So let's take these two as an example. I want to go between 0, 1/3, 1, and 1/3, 1, 1. Okay. How can I do this? I can interpolate any different pair of points. So the 1 and the 1, I can't interpolate between those, they're already the same. And I can't interpolate between the 1/3 and the 1/3, they're already the same. But I could interpolate between the 1 and the 1/3. I can interpolate between the 1 and the 0. I can interpolate between the 1/3 and the 1. All of those would work. And they would all find places with the blossom coordinates. In practice, I'm trying to get a lot of 1/3s. So I'm going to take the ones that aren't 1/3 and try to get them there so that I can find this point 1/3, 1/3, 1/3, or 1/4, 1/4, and 1/4, or whatever point I'm trying to find on my curve. Yes?
So you're trying to find the 1/3, 1/3, 1/3, but that's not a point, so what is it?
It is a blossom coordinate.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the name of a spot on a Bezier.
Spot?
It's the name of a particular spot. If all three of these coordinates are the same, so 0, 0, 0, 1/3, 1/3, 1/3, 1, 1, 1, that point is on the curve. If they aren't all the same, then it's not on the curve. It's extra information to be able to eventually find something on the curve. Okay? So the set of all of the points on the curve are 0, 0, 0 through 1, 1, 1. And if I were to find all of those points that have all three coordinates the same, between 0 and 1, that will be the whole Bezier curve. Question?
What if there are more than one pair of different things? Do you interpolate both of them?
You pick one. You have to do them one at a time. It actually doesn't matter which pair you do first. We're actually going to see that when we get to B-splines in a moment. For Beziers, there will always be one that is neither where you want to go nor the end, nor the same.
Can you only interpolate between adjacent points on the Bezier? Could I interpolate between 0, 0, 0 and 1,
1, 1? No. You have to do adjacent blossoms. I'm not 100% sure that's true. But you always do adjacent blossoms. Here, and then here, and then here. Yes?
So could you theoretically, for the fourth point, instead of like 1, 1, 1, could that be like 0, 1, 0?
Yeah, we'll get to that when you get to B-splines. So we're going to make more complicated blossoms, or how we create B-splines. We'll see that in a moment. Here.
Yeah, I was going to ask how you decided what the 4 or the 12
points
coordinates
were.
Can you just
explain? So for a Bezier curve, they're all the same at the two ends, and we change one coordinate of the blossom at a time as we go between. That's just the in blossom space, that's the definition of a Bezier curve. Okay? And it recreates the de Castelgeau algorithm if we interpolate in the right way. Yeah?
Is that point the same point at like t equals 1/3?
This is t equals 1/3, yep. So that's t equals 1/3, this is t equals 0. And this is t equals 1. And all of the rest of them aren't on the curve. They're just helpers to find the one on the curve. Yeah?
Just to clarify, so the operation that we're doing is that between two adjacent points, we like average,
We can find, so between this point and this point, there's one differing pair of coordinates.
Okay.
And I can interpolate to any location I want linearly. So if I wanted a quarter, it'd be there. If I wanted a half, it'd be there. If I wanted 9/10, it'd be there.
Okay.
And my goal, I can do this however I want. I can play with this in any way I want, but my end goal is to end up with a point where all of them are the same to find a point on the curve.
And as long as that's true, you will plot that as a
If they end up all being the same, it is a point on the Bezier curve.
Okay.
Yeah?
So instead of choosing like 1/3, you could just choose like 9/10, but you'd have to be consistent.
Yep, if I chose 9/10 all the way along, then I would eventually end up with the point that's 9/10 of the way down the curve. But I need to be consistent because I can't arbitrarily plot between 1/3, 1/3, and 1/3, and 1/1/1. I'd have to get the 9/10 along the way. Now, I can see that I had overestimated the number of you that would think this was mathematically elegant. Maybe more of you will think it was mathematically elegant, maybe not, when I describe how B-splines work. So B-spline is also using blossoms. Okay? But the initial blossoms are defined differently. The initial blossoms are things like 1, 2, 3, 2, 3, 4, 3, 4, 5, 5, 6, 7. Let's arbitrarily make this like, not 5, 6, 7, 4, 5, 6, sorry. 4, 5, let's just skip one here to show a point. 5, 7, 8, and 7, 8, 9. We can pick any numbers we want. They need to all be different. They need to be in ascending order, and each adjacent pair of points needs to share 2. Okay? And so I skipped 6, and we'll talk about why I skipped 6 in a bit, but I do this. The same rules apply for B-splines as for Bezier curves. I can interpolate between these by interpolating one coordinate at a time. So as I think about how to interpolate between this point and this point, the one that's different is the 1 and the 4. So a linear interpolation between these points interpolates between 1 and 4. Okay? And so let's try to find the point 3, 3, 3. Okay, we're just going to look for the point 3, 3, 3. So I have 1 and 4. I want to get a 3, which means I need to go 2/3 of the way between 1 and 3. So I'm going to now have 2, 3, 3. 2/3 of the way between 1 and 4. Okay, I also can interpolate between these. These have 3s, that's promising. These share the 3 and the 4, but they differ in 2 and 5. So I need to go 1/3 of the way there to get between that. So now I'll have 3, 3, 4. And then when I interpolate between these, I will go halfway to find 3, 3, 3. If we think about what let's also find 4, 4, 4. And then we will see how this relates to the other system. Okay? So I found 3, 3, 3. Let's now find 4, 4, 4. Let's do that in a different color. Okay? So these two both have 4. I need to interpolate between 2 and 5. I need to go 2/3 of the way to find 3, 4, 4. These two both have 4. I need to interpolate between the 3 and the 7. And I probably should have picked a 6 there. We'll go ahead and do this anyway. So that means I need to go 1/4 of the way to get, what's that going to be? 4, 4, 5. And then between these two, I go halfway to get to my 4, 4, 4. And then these points have the blossoms of a Bezier curve. This is the algorithm we did earlier to create Bezier curves out of B-splines. We are chopping each segment into thirds. We're connecting adjacent points and going halfway between them. Poof, Bezier curve. With the exception that I use 7 here, which made it slightly more complicated. We'll come back to that in a moment. Yes?
How did you figure that you want the 3, 3, 3, 4, 4? Why not like 2, 2, 2 plus 4?
I picked these two because I knew where they would end up. How would I find 2, 2, 2? So I can easily find 1, sorry, I can go between, I want the twos, I want to keep the threes, so I can find 2, 2, 3. I have 2, 2, 3 and 2, 3, 3. I can't get to 2, 2, 2. Because this is an endpoint, I don't have enough information, which is what I said earlier about we're making something up at the ends. Okay? And we could actually define what we're making up in the end by giving this a different blossom, and anyway, there's various things we could do to define what's going on. Yes?
If these are sets, right, that's why like don't if they only have to differ by one.
Yep. Code. Yep. They have no order. Yes?
And you pick sets of three numbers because you knew you were going to a cubic.
Because I wanted a cubic curve. If I had picked sets of four, I would have got quartic curves. If I had picked sets of two, I would have got quadratic curves. I could have picked any size set I want to get a different order. Okay? And we could have then figured out, okay, what are the curves we're creating with different size sets and so on, and actually figured out what these curves are.
So when you wanted to get 3, 3, 3, how did you know programmatically to look at the two points that were kind of next to you?
So to find 3, 3, 3, I'm going to interpolate between all of the things that have threes.
Okay.
And that'll generate more things with threes, and I'll interpolate between those until I get 3, 3, 3. Other questions? Yeah.
Are you guaranteed to find it? When you say find 3, 3, 3,
yes, if. You're guaranteed to find it if it is inside the curve, which means that the earliest point has a number less than it, and the latest point has a number greater than it, and you pick points in the right order. There are more complicated rules. How would I find 2.5, 2.5, 2.5? There are rules. You can pick points and eventually get there, okay? We aren't going to go into all of them because I don't want to spend all day on B-splines. Okay. Other questions? Yeah?
What are we finding? I mean, I know we're getting...
We are finding a curve.
But, how does that find a curve? Because I don't understand...
All of the points that have the same coordinates are on the curve.
So we just have... But, I mean, aren't there,
There's an infinite number of points on the curve.
Okay, but we would choose some,
This curve is defined between 3 and the smallest value of the last blossom is 7. So every 3, 3, 3 through 7, 7, 7 with every real number in between exists on the curve and can be found in this way. Okay. Now, I did something weird here by skipping 6. And you notice because I skipped 6, I did a quarter instead of a third of the way down. That makes this have a non-uniform spacing. It essentially makes this edge more important. When I'm making non-uniform spacing, it makes some space, some edge matter more. It makes the curve get closer to it, or farther from it, depending whether I'm making closer or farther apart. And we can use this to adjust the relative importance of different parts of the curve. And so sometimes we will talk about non-uniform B-splines, okay, which we could call nubs, non-uniform B-splines. Usually, though, we don't call them nubs. We throw an R in the middle. And the R stands for rational, okay? Rational B-splines are slightly messy to describe, okay? The rational means I am going to divide all of these coordinates by another value I interpolated along the way as a rational number. So as I think about it, I drew this at some point. That suggests it has an x and a y. And this has an x and a y. That's what I meant by drawing it somewhere. And as I am interpolating, I am finding the x and a y of some point on the curve. For a rational B-spline, I also find a W. And then the point I draw is X over W, Y over W, not X, Y. These are rational numbers, hence rational B-spline. It turns out that by interpolating something else and dividing by it, you can do nice things like conic sections and perfect circles and so on. Although how you get there is more math than I want to do today. But it gives us a little bit of extra power. And thus we get the almighty NURB, which is commonly used, the non-rational uniform it's a non-uniform rational B-spline. It's a B-spline with an extra coordinate we divide by, and some of the edges can be more important than others. Usually when artists use NURBS, they don't understand what to do with the non-uniformity or the rationality, and they just ignore it. Okay, but then they will say, make me a circle, and it will be something they were incapable of making themselves because they didn't know how to pick the right W's, right? And this makes them less valuable for artists than they might initially feel. But they were very popular. In the 90s, these were the thing. Then Catmull Clark fixed that, and we may talk a little about that later. All right, questions about our splines? Yeah?
So you said it would be more complicated, but can you give a little bit of an idea of how to find like any real number on the curve? Like,
sure. The simple way is find the Bezier curve that encloses it and then do what we just did for Beziers.
Okay.
How do I write that in code? How do I know that that's what I need to do? A little bit more complicated, but it's not that bad, right? If I wanted to find 6.3, I would realize that my blossoms don't have 6, but 6.3 is between 5 and 7. So I'm going to need 5.5.5. And then I'm going to need 7.7.7, and then I'm going to have to interpolate between them. Does that help?
Yeah.
Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
Can you give an example of like a line that's non-uniform, like actually drawn?
What does it look like? Ooh, I don't know if I can eyeball it.
Like you said, one edge is more important.
Yeah, it will be closer to, I can't even remember if it's closer to the edge that has a shorter interval or a larger interval. So this is actually the important edge, I believe, because that's the one that goes between 5 and 7 in both of its blossoms. So that's the edge that we've decided encompasses more of the parameter space. And I don't remember whether it streaks to it closely or not. So we're going to have a quarter there. And we're going to have a quarter there. Yeah, so it means the control points are going to be farther away from it. So it's going to be a little looser. It's going to not get as close to these control points as it would to the others. Yeah.
Okay. So the lowest number maybe.
In the blossom?
The blossom coordinates is 1, and the highest is 9, right?
As I have drawn it, yes.
Yeah. Okay. So like.
But the lowest point that the curve is defined for is 3, and the highest point the curve is defined for is 7.
Okay. Well, so what I was going to ask is like, does that mean if you find point like 5.5.5, that's like the dead center of the B-spline?
In parameter space, but not necessarily in geography.
So, like in terms of like magnitude of the curve.
In terms of arc length, no.
Yeah.
But in terms of parameter space, yes. So what we're defining here is a parametric curve. We have a function of x as a value of t, which t is these numbers. And y is a value of t, and w is a value of t if we're doing rational. But these numbers don't have to be different. Just as a simple example, let's suppose I have point, 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 point. Okay? If I were to figure out where the middle of it is, it's probably going to be somewhere over here. Because I'm going to subdivide these, and I'm going to subdivide this, and then I'm going to connect these pieces across, and I'm going to end up figuring out that I have a point way over here that's the parameter middle, but not the geographic middle, because the points were evenly distributed. So the ratio between the t space and the xy space is somewhat arbitrary. There, we could derive the math of figuring out arc length and so on, and it's actually not bad mathematically, but it's bad to describe, so we're not going to dive down that rabbit hole in this class, unless we decide to later in the semester. Okay. Other questions about NURBS? I realize I've done sort of a hand-wavy description with a little bit of math to confuse you. What do I expect you to actually know walking away from this? I expect people to be able to talk about NURBS and you not be, I wonder what that is. Number one goal, okay? I don't necessarily expect you to be able to sit down and write NURBS. OK? Okay? I don't even have NURBS as an optional characteristic of your homework. I do have cubic B-splines as an optional, and for some reason it's not loading. Ah, here we are. So I do have one B-spline. I have the uniform cubic B-spline. That's the only one I have. Because I think if you can get that one, you've got enough that you could do the rest if you wanted to spend the time. Okay? Do you need to do this? No, it's optional, right? So what do I expect you to understand? I do expect you to understand that a B-spline creates Bezier curves. I expect you to understand that there's some notion of partial but not complete continuity. Right? That we have continuity curvature, but not necessarily arbitrary differentiability, although we haven't talked about differentiability yet, so we may come back to that later. And that they're widely used by artists because they have this localized control. That's another important piece, this idea of localized control. That moving one control point only moves the portion of the curve that's close to it, unlike a Bezier curve, which moves the whole thing. Questions about splines? All right. Let's talk about blobbies. Let's begin talking about blobbies just by looking for... I'm going to get all kinds of things I don't want to see, aren't I? Yeah. Yeah, this will work. All right. What on earth is this?
Green pepper.
Yeah, this is supposed to be a simulation of water splashing into a cup.
Oh.
Okay? And the way they simulated it is they put individual little points, pretended they were balls, applied something called smooth particle hydrodynamics that we're not going to talk about right now. And I can tell this all just by looking. I've clearly done this course too many times. Anyway, and then figure out where all the points are and then said, we need to render it. And so we're gonna make these blobby shapes. We're gonna like smear the balls into each other. How do you smear balls into each other? Okay, this is blobbies. There's other words for this. We could call them smooth surface, isosurfaces, and other things. But we're just going to talk about them in 2D for starters. We're actually going to talk about them in 1D for real starters. Okay, in 1D, what am I going to have? A point in 1D only has an x-coordinate. Okay, and I'm going to create this potential function. The traditional potential function looks like a bell curve. Okay, so I'm going to create the potential function, a normal curve of some sort, usually actually not quite normal because I want it to have bounded support, not go forever. So make something that sort of curves up and looks bellish. And then I will pick some threshold. I will pick some arbitrary space that is as much as I care about, and I will say, anywhere this curve was above it, I draw it. Anywhere it wasn't, I don't. And so what I will draw for this is just a line segment because it is 1D. Okay? The interesting thing about this, though, is what happens if I have two points. I'll make another point over here, and it will also have its bell curve. And then I will just add these bell curves together. Let's see if I can visually add bell curves. I'm not great at this, but I will do my best. I will get some sort of camel hump. Bactrian, not dromedary. One of them is a dromedary. All right. And then when I look at what's the threshold, I will see, ooh, they have merged together. I get one big line segment. Okay. Now, for 1D, this is not super interesting. It's harder to draw for 2D. It is really hard to draw for 3D. So we're going to start with 1D, and we're going to move up to 2D. Before I move up to 2D, questions about how I did any piece of the 1D version?
You just added the functions.
I just added the functions, found some threshold, drew where it was above that. All right. Now let's imagine it is 2D. So I have some plane. And I have, essentially, these potential functions are going to be these circular hills on the plane. Okay? And when I have two of them some distance apart, and I cut them at some particular altitude, I find I'm drawing, if I were to then draw this, I would have circles. Okay? Because they're far enough apart, they're not adding on top of each other in any meaningful way. As they get closer together, I'm not going to see circles anymore. Okay? So as I put some hill that sort of overlaps with the other hill, they're going to add together in the middle. And that is going to be, there would sort of be the circle here, but these two are going to add together and they're sort of going to connect. Like two little droplets bumping into each other. And as I move them apart, they will pop apart, and as I pull them together, they will merge, and when they're completely on top of each other, there'll be a bigger circle, and when they're completely far apart, there'll be two little circles, and they will behave in a gloopy kind of fashion. And the gloopiness is what we want. Let's look and see what our reading on blobbies had to say about this. So this has pictures of what they look like. Right? When they're far apart, in 3D, they're spheres. As you get closer together, that four-dimensional hill bumps into another four-dimensional hill, and they merge and become this sort of merging together. They also have lots of pictures about how this works over time, right? And they try to color code it and show how it works as they move on top of each other. We get this smoothing behavior between them. These are not hard to build. It's not hard to define potential functions. They even give an example curve that works. This right here works. You can try it. There are other fancier ones that they have things to. Drawing them in 3D is a bit tricky. And we may talk about marching cubes as we talk more about 3D, the classic algorithm for here, and marching tetrahedrons is slightly easier. It's a little bit of code to write, but in the end, drawing them is pretty easy. In drawing them in 2D, I can literally just scan through every single pixel, and anytime the sum of all of the potential functions is bigger than some number, I draw that pixel. Okay? Straightforward to do. It's computationally a bit expensive if I have to add all of them up, which is why we generally try to find functions that go to zero at some point, so we can bound and not look at some. There's various efficiencies we can make. It is relatively uncommon to actually use blobbies in 2D. It occasionally happens. It's not very common. The more common way of doing it is you didn't actually start with points. So let's just briefly pull up a graphics program here. Oh my. Let's get rid of that. And I will just arbitrarily wiggle something out here. Huzzah. All right. Let me select that and zoom in on it. All right. So I have some arbitrary shape I've created with my pen. I can now come in here and I can outset this curve. Okay? And this is essentially treating every point along the curve as a little blobby and adding them all up together and then finding the new boundary of the curve. And so I can do that as often as I want, right? And so I can, if I can remember the keyboard shortcut, I can just sort of merge it together, okay? This is occasionally useful in 2D. Notice that it's not reversible because I lost what used to be there. When I continually do it and then replace the curve with the new curve, it's not actually storing points and changing their potential functions. Some graphics programs will let you find points and change their potential functions instead, and then it is reversible. They vary a little bit. This is usually sort of a niche behavior of a graphics tool in 2D. Not particularly common, not even something I'm going to let you do for optional credit in this assignment, okay? But if we can understand it in 2D, when we come back to it in 3D, where it shows up a lot more, it will make more sense, I think. And it is an option that has used occasionally in graphics programs. I believe the CorelDRAW program that was basically ousted by Adobe InDesign later did this quite a bit. And then it turned out Adobe didn't like it. Anyway, side note. Questions about blobbies?
So Adobe doesn't.
I don't know. I haven't used Adobe's in years. But last time I used Adobe, I couldn't find them. That doesn't mean Adobe didn't have them. If you've used Adobe, Not being able to find something does not mean it doesn't exist. Because it does so many things. They have not made it, however, into any of the major vector graphics libraries, file formats. There's no blobby in SVG, and I don't think there is an AI. The major file formats don't have ways of representing them. Because it turns out artists just didn't want them very often. So we stopped providing the ability. Okay. That was what we wanted to say about curves, I think. Questions about curves? Yeah?
What are always used in 3D?
Liquids, very often. Okay. They are used for other things occasionally, but usually as a way of drawing liquids. Actually, they are reasonably popular in protein visualizations because we don't proteins don't look like anything. They're smaller than the wavelengths of light, so we pretend like they were blobby things instead. I'll bet if I haven't tried this, but let's just try going in here and just doing a protein folding. I spelled protein wrong, but that's all right. 3D. Maybe I'm not going to see blobbies. I'm seeing a lot of ribbons. Probably shouldn't have used folding. Well, maybe this didn't work. I made a bad bet. Nope, that one doesn't. This one doesn't. No, I'm not seeing them. Occasionally you'll see them. They've sort of fallen out of fashion in recent years. And I don't really know how to predict what fashions will go. But they come back from time to time. Marching cube. Well, that's not interesting either. No, I'm not finding any good examples just in random Google searches, image searches I hadn't prepared in advance. Yeah, this is a printed, this is a 3D printed version of blobbies. So here they actually computed blobbies and then printed it out on a printer to make some protein. Because they stick together nicely anyway. But yeah, they're not widely used outside of liquid. I should comment, the general term for this is an isosurface. Not vital important, but it's vaguely important to know. What does iso mean? Same. What is it that they're the same? They're the same threshold. So the isosurface is technically just the boundary around the outside of the blobby. It would be the iso curve in 2D, the isosurface in 3D. And so often what we do is we extract the isosurface and then we render that as a bunch of triangles. And we'll talk some more about that in the 3D space. Other questions? All right. So we had fragment shaders as our other topic for the day. This is different. Let's clear our lines of curves. Stop thinking in crooked ways. All right. First, let's just define fragment. Fragment is another of our classic examples in computing. We use English words wrong, right? You've been in the field long enough, you should be used to this. Right? Sometime you should just pause and try to ask yourself what other people hear when you talk about the Java stack. Anyway, so the fragment. A fragment is what we call a pixel from one or more objects. Let's think about what this might mean. So, we have talked about how we draw triangles. Okay? And along the way of drawing triangles, we ended up finding the pixels they were on top of. Those pixels they were on top of are a fragment. And notably, this pixel here has a fragment for each of the two triangles. Okay? There is a fragment from this triangle and a fragment from this triangle, both on that pixel, both with the same pixel coordinates. And those fragments might look different. Okay? Maybe this was supposed to be a red triangle here. And so maybe I have a red opaque fragment. And maybe this over here was supposed to be a transparent blue triangle. And so maybe I have a blue transparent fragment. We have seen how to use DDA or blobbies or other techniques to discover what the fragments are. And then what we have to do is decide, what do I actually put on the screen at that point? And so the fragment shading, the idea of fragment working, is actually two pieces. One is, given a pixel, what should it look like by itself? And then given all of the objects that contribute to that pixel, how do they all combine? We'll talk more about fragment shading, how we just light things, when we talk about 3D, where it will matter more. For here, we're just going to assume we already have the details of each fragment. And now we need to know, given all of the fragments into place, how do we draw the result? Okay, so I have a red opaque fragment and a blue transparent fragment. What should this pixel look like?
Purpley.
Okay, so I could have purpley.
Which one's on top?
I don't know. You tell me.
Red's opaque and blue is transparent.
Red's opaque and blue is transparent.
Yes.
So what should I draw?
You should see most of red.
See most of red. Huh?
Doesn't it depend how transparent it is?
Or less.
Depends on the order of the...
Okay, what if it's in the other order?
If it's blue on the bottom?
Yeah.
Then you see only red.
All red. Okay? Deciding what to draw here depends on all of these pieces. So I generally need some sense of order. And I need some way of compositing or combining the elements. And the way I composite or combine typically depends on their transparentiness and on their order, and sometimes on other things. If these were light, not object, then maybe I'm going to see red light and blue light, and therefore see magenta light. I don't know, right? It depends on how I am compositing them. So, there's lots of different things we could think about. The most common extra characteristics we have that don't show up on the screen but help us do this compositing are Z, and here we're going to talk about the Z index or order, and then we often think about the alpha. Z is just a way of saying which one's on top. It's a way of saying which one's on top without knowing in advance which one's on top. The simplest way to know which one's on top is the last one I drew is on top, and the first one I drew is on the bottom. And so I can just say the order they appear is the order they show up. This is what the code that you are writing for homework 2 does. You draw the first thing, and then the next thing, and then the next thing, and that is implicitly their order. But we could have said, this thing has a Z of 3, and this thing has a Z of 200. And then we have to ask ourselves, is bigger on top or on bottom? It's not clear. And actually, both are used, just to be confusing. Okay? So just knowing the Z doesn't tell you what you can see. You need to look further into the documentation of whatever defines Z to know whether Z, big Z's are on top or big Z's are on bottom. And sometimes they will change. And anyway, we'll get lots more into how we map numbers into actually what's on top as we talk about 3D later. But often in 2D, we will just have a notion of Z index. And it will be defined in some place whether big or small indices show up on top. Okay? We don't care about the numbers, we just care about the order. So it doesn't matter whether it was 200 or 4, they're both bigger than 3. And I would expect to see the same thing in both cases. The alpha could mean just about anything. Most commonly, we think about opacity. But we don't need to think about opacity. We could think about glowiness. We could think about bleed. We could think about underness, and on and on and on. Okay. Usually, if you just hear alpha, think opacity. Notably, not transparency. Bigger alphas are more opaque, not more transparent. In almost every case, though not everyone. And then we have to decide, given two colors, we know which one's on top and we know they're alphas, what is the final result? We talked a little bit about this earlier when we were talking about half-shading things and so on, this notion of combining colors. Let's look a little bit more at, let's see if I had this link and then nope, that definitely didn't work. Operator totally trounced that. Nope. Nope. All right. W3CSVG. Here we go. Nope. No. Wow, this is so hard to find. I want the spec. I want the technical report. Ah, here it is. Okay. Sorry, I had this up and then my computer shut down and anyway, I may not be able to get it. Nope, it's not there. All right, we will just talk about from the Wikipedia article because that one works as well. It doesn't have quite all of them, but on the schedule, the page I had you look at for alpha has these examples. Okay. Opaque and transparent with one over the other, then it has this in operator where I only see it if they were in both of them, where I can have the out operator where I only see it if it's in one and out of the other, or I can have the atop where I only see it if it's over top of something else, but if it's not over top, it's invisible, right? Why would you ever do this? Why would I do atop? You actually use this probably not more often than you expect. What's a use case for a top?
Illustrator kind of has like viewports for different, so it's like everything has to be in this frame.
Yeah.
Masking like a one layer above another.
Yeah. A common case is I make an oval or circular portrait. How do I do that? I take a square portrait and I say a circle and I say only show me the portrait where it's over top of the circle. Right, so over actually turns out to be fairly common in practice. And it really doesn't matter what the alpha is here, right? That didn't really matter. When we have these other partial transparents, we decide what we do about things. We have XOR, because, you know, why not? We can. And then they have these ideas about over top and underneath and how do we combine the colors and so on. There are lots of different algorithms. The most common is given right here as the over operator. This is the most common composition algorithm. Okay? And it looks really messy. All this really says is, I see as much of the thing on top as it is opaque, and the rest of what I see is the thing on bottom. Mathematically, that looks like this. There are other ways of working through it. The Wikipedia tries to walk through it. This is the most common way of applying how we see things, right? We take the alpha of some object times its own color, times the inverse of alpha times the other color, but the other one might also be transparent, so we take its alpha as well, and then we normalize. That's all this really is doing. And it also computes the alpha channel. Do you have to do this? No. There are lots and lots and lots of composition algorithms. But this is the one that will make things look sort of like half-painted transparencies stacked up, which for whatever reason is what we usually decide alpha means. You got a question?
Yeah. Is there a way to like determine the color of the pixel without worrying about the order in which you draw things?
Yes. So additive, for example, would do this. I need, what do I need? I need an associative operator. This is not associative, okay? An associative operator treats all of the pixels equally. So if I pretending that all I am seeing is light, and I just add all of the reds, all of the greens, and all of the blues, this is associative, and it doesn't matter what order they came in. It also tends to make everything look bright and bleary, so we don't use it very much. It tends to be that associative operators are not what eyes expect, because the real world cares what's on top. Other questions? Okay. We will end there. I will see you, some of you, on Thursday for a math primer.